Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Genesis chapter 37, verses 18 through 36. This section of scripture I will entitle Joseph's Big Dreams Get Him Into Big Trouble. Our context is this. In the previous audio, I covered the first 17 verses, the first half of Genesis 37, and I entitled that section Joseph Dreams Big. Those were the two dreams that Joseph had in which his brother's sheaves bowed down to his sheaves, and the sun and the moon and the stars did him obeisance. The interpretation of the dreams was obvious. The brothers don't like it, and now Joseph is going to reap the fruit of his naive pushing of his dreams on his family. So we start now in Genesis 37, verses 18 through 22. When they, that's Joseph's brothers, saw him from a distance. They're in Dothan now, which is 13 miles north of Shechem. Shechem being on the main drag there between, if you go south from Shechem, you go to Shechem, to Ramah, to Jerusalem, to Bethlehem, to Hebron, and Dothan is even north of Shechem. When they, Joseph's brothers, saw Joseph from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard this and rescued Joseph out of their hands, out of his brother's hands, and said, "Let us not take his life." Reuben further said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father." Now the brothers saw him from a distance. First question is, how could they recognize Joseph as he walked up the road to Dothan? Here are some possibilities. He was young. He was only 17. His young stature might have tipped them off. Maybe his gestures, his manner of walking. Maybe it was his coat of many colors, his very colored tunic. But somehow they recognized him, and they had a little bit of time to do some plotting. Now, it was not a lot of time, you would think. He was walking. They might have been up on a hill and saw him way off in the distance. But it had to be a short enough time for them to recognize Joseph and then for Joseph to get there. During that time, they devised their plot to kill him. They didn't take much time about it because their attitude towards him was already pretty poisoned. They said, "Here comes this dreamer." Of course, they're referring to Jacob's two dreams in which he took priority over his brothers. The original Hebrew is dream expert or master of dreams. So when they say, "Here comes this dreamer," they're really saying, according to the original Hebrew, "Here comes this dream expert. Here comes this master of dreams." The sarcasm is obvious there. I had four commentators that pointed that out, the original Hebrew. "Now then, come let us kill him," they said to each other. And Adam Clark says in response to that, quote, "What unprincipled savages the brothers must have been." Now, I think about this. This is the patriarchs of Israel that Adam Clark is talking about here, the unprincipled savages. That's one thing about the Old Testament. It doesn't sugarcoat anything. All the warts of the ancient Israelites and the patriarchs are out there for us to see. Reuben heard this. He listened to all the plotting to kill. And it says in verse 21, Reuben rescued Joseph. And how did he do it? He said, "Let's don't take his life." He further said, "Shed no blood, throw him into a pit." Well, now, think about this. Shed no blood, but throw him into a pit. You throw somebody in a pit that's in the wilderness, it says, and you don't give him any food and you don't give him any water, he's going to die. So what Reuben actually said was, hey, brothers, you want to kill him? Well, let's kill him, but let's don't do it directly. Let's just put him in the pit so that he'll die and we won't have our bloods directly on our hands. Now, that's what the other brothers thought. Reuben, on the other hand, was planning to come back and get Joseph out and rescue him. Now, why did Reuben want to save Joseph? Well, the NIV Study Bible says, as the eldest brother, Reuben probably felt responsible for Joseph. He knew he would have to answer to Jacob, "How could you let this happen to my son to get killed by your brothers?" And he didn't want to face that, especially after he had already had incest with Jacob's concubine Bilhah, thus making a premature claim on Jacob's inheritance. So he figured that, hey, I've already done enough to get myself in trouble. I don't want to get myself into further trouble, so I'm going to save Joseph. Or it could be just that he had compassion for Joseph because Joseph was his blood brother, or at least his half-brother. Reuben's mother was Leah, and Joseph's mother was Rachel, but they had the common father, Jacob. Now, it's interesting that Reuben got to say, "I told you so." we go far ahead in Genesis 42:22. This is when the brothers are in Egypt. Reuben answered them, his brother, saying, "Did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen? Now comes the reckoning for his blood." They thought they were going to die down there in Egypt. So Reuben got to say, "I told you so." Now, some speculate that Reuben also might have advised the brothers not to sell him into slavery. I don't know. It seems to me that was an afterthought when they saw the slave traders. I think the brothers were trying to kill him when they threw him into the pit. We know for sure that Reuben advised against killing Joseph, and we know that the brothers did, as a matter of fact, listen to that advice, but we don't know about any advice about selling him into slavery. Now, a question arises, why didn't Reuben just try to save David outright instead of saying, "Well, let's throw him into a pit," which would mean murder? And my opinion about that is that Reuben probably realized, these brothers of mine are so full of hatred, there's no way I can talk them out of killing David, so I'll just say, "Well, let's kill him, but now let's don't do it directly. Let's put him in a pit so he'll die on his own and we won't be around when it happens. Maybe we can separate ourselves from the deed so people won't see the blood on our hands." He realized, given the brothers' malice, Reuben did, that he would not win the argument about saving David's life. We go now to Genesis 37, verses 23 through 25. So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him, and they took him and threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty without any water in it. Then they sat down to eat a meal. And as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Now let's think about what Joseph was confronted with here, what he thought. This is what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, quote, "Imagine him advancing in all the unsuspecting openness of brotherly affection. How astonished and terrified must he have been at the cold reception, the ferocious aspect, the rough usage of his unnatural assailants. A vivid picture of his state of agony and despair was afterwards drawn by themselves." And Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown directs us to Genesis 42:21, and we see what Joseph thought when he showed up at Dothan to see his brothers. Genesis 42:21, "Then they said to one another," this is while they're down in Egypt, "truly we are guilty concerning our brother, because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet we would not listen. Therefore this distress has come upon us." Joseph got up there, realized they were going to kill him or throw him into the pit. He was distressed, and he begged his brothers, "Don't do this, don't do this," and they didn't listen. Now let's talk about the attitude of the brothers. This is also from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, quote, "It is impossible that mere envy at his dreams, his gaudy dress, or the doting partiality of their common father, could have goaded them on to such a pitch of frenzied resentment or confirmed them in such consummate wickedness. Their hatred to Joseph must have had a far deeper seat. It must have been produced by dislike to his piety and other excellencies, which made his character and conduct a constant censure upon theirs, and on account of which they found they could never be at ease till they had rid themselves of his hated presence." Well, okay, so Joseph is more pious than they are. They're envious of his dreams, they're envious of his multicolored tunic. They don't like Joseph because Jacob favored Joseph over them and so forth. So they had a lot of reasons why they wanted to kill him. But basically, to kill your own brother, that's pretty doggone evil and disgusting. So they stripped Joseph of his many-colored tunic. Now, this is ironically similar to what happened to Joseph later when he was sold down into slavery into Egypt. He was an innocent man, just like he was here with his brothers. Potiphar's wife falsely accused him of trying to seduce her. She had Joseph's cloak stripped from him. We'll see that when we get to the story. And he was rescued. Likewise here, he was stripped of his coat, he was falsely accused, and he was rescued. Now, why did the brothers strip Joseph of his many-colored tunic? That was so that Joseph would not look like a man of distinction. Just think, if people found Joseph in the pit, starved to death, and he's dressed with this fancy tunic that the virgin daughters of kings probably wore, they're going to think, this is a big shot. Somebody just killed a big shot. Maybe we better look into this and see who did this. So they took the coat off of him so that Joseph would just look like a common corpse. The detail is mentioned in verse 24 that the pit they threw Joseph in had no water. Why was that little detail mentioned? Well, there's a couple of reasons, perhaps. One was to show that Reuben intentionally directed them to a dry pit so Joseph wouldn't be drowned, so Reuben could rescue him later. That's reasonable. Another reason that the detail might have mentioned was to show the straits that Joseph was in. He had no water to drink. So after the dirty deed was done, the brothers sat down and they ate a meal, the scripture says here in verse 25, Genesis 37, they sat down to eat a meal. Now that shows a complete lack of conscience. They sat down to enjoy themselves and feast. No qualms of conscience here. They just attempted to murder their brother, laid the groundwork of the murder of their brother, the groundwork of their brother's killing, and they sit down to feast about it. Well, they were eating and they looked up and there was a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Now, these Ishmaelites are called Midianites in verse 28. Here in verse 25, they're Ishmaelites, and somewhere else they're called Midianites. I don't have the quote in front of me. And so we need to clear up this situation as why they had different names. Well, the NIV Study Bible says it's because the Ishmaelites were related to the Midianites. As a matter of fact, Midian and Medan and Ishmael were all sons of Abraham. Ishmael through Hagar, Abraham and Agar, and Midian and Medan, Abraham gave birth to by his marriage to Keturah, who he married later after Sarah. Genesis 25:2, she, this is referring to Keturah, bore to Abraham, Zimram and Jokshan, and Medan and Midian. There's Medan and Midian and Ishbak and Shua. So that's two of them were descendants of Abraham. And of course, Ishmael, we know the story about Hagar and Ishmael. And so these people were floating around in the Arabian deserts around. And so they had picked up different names, Ishmaelites and Midianites, whatever. So let me read what Jameson Fawcett Brown says about the Ishmaelites. Quote, a traveling caravan composed of a mixed association of Arabians. Those tribes of northern Arabia had already addicted themselves to commerce, and long did they enjoy a monopoly, the carrying trade being entirely in their hands. That's because nobody could get across the deserts, I suppose. Their approach could easily be seen, for as their road, after crossing the ford from the Transjordanic district, led along the south side of the mountains of Gilboa. Now, let's do a little geography here. Remember, Shechem is up there in Samaria, right north of Jerusalem, 60 miles north of Hebron. Then you go to Dothan's, even further north of that. If you go further north, you'll end up at the plain of Esdraelon, where the valley of the Esdraelon runs into the Jordan River right south of the Sea of Galilee. So if you cross the Jordan River coming from the east of the Jordan River is called Gilead. You cross the Jordan River there to the south of Gilboa, to the north of Dothan, they could be seen. Continuing with Jameson Fawcett and Brown, a party seated on the plain of Dothan could trace them and their string of camels in the distance as they proceeded through the broad and gently sloping valley that intervenes. Trading in the produce of Arabia and India, they were in the regular course of traffic on their way to Egypt. So this is basically between India and Egypt. That's where all the spices were coming from India. And they were heading toward Egypt. Now, there was a couple ways to get to Egypt. They could have, when they got to Dothan and Shechem, they could have gone straight down that road down there to Hebron and then going over to Bathsheba and then headed west to Egypt. Or they could have just, where they were, as soon as they crossed the Jordan River there, north of Dothan, could have continued west till they got to the coast of the Mediterranean and got on the highway there that runs along the coast down to Egypt. If they'd have gone straight south from Hebron, they would have run into Hebron, where Jacob lived, and Jacob might have found out about his son being sold into slavery, so we can speculate that perhaps the merchants went straight west to the Mediterranean Sea and then went south to Egypt. Now, these merchants were trading in aromatic gum, the NIV says spices, they were trading in balm. And balm, there's one particular balm that's especially effective, the balm of Gilead, which is where they were coming from, remember, from the east of the Jordan River. The balm of Gilead was considered especially effective in the scriptures, Jeremiah 8:22. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then has not the health of the daughter of my people been restored? Jeremiah 46:11, go up to Gilead and obtain balm, O virgin daughter of Egypt. So the Egyptians would buy balm from Gilead, which again is in the area right east of the Jordan River, going from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. Balm and other spices were especially valuable for embalming in Egypt. I don't know if embalming has something to do with that word. I suspect it does. Putting balm into the corpse, embalming. Well, it's very important in Egypt. As we know, they love to embalm their mummies, and these traders could have been trading in those kind of spices in order to do embalming in Egypt. Now, the myrrh that they carried, that was probably an aromatic gum from leaves of the cistus rose, says the NIV Study Bible. Whatever the cistus rose is, I don't know, but myrrh was used in beauty treatments. We read in Esther 2:12, "Now when the turn of each young lady came to go into King Ahasuerus," that's Xerxes, that's each young lady in Xerxes' harem, "after the end of her 12 months under the regulations for the women, the days of their beautification were completed as follows: 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with spices and the cosmetics for women. 6 months rubbing her down so she's ready for the king to have sex with him, all oiled up with myrrh. Myrrh was considered valuable as a king's gift," Matthew 2:11. This is from the Christmas story. "After coming into the house," the wise men we're talking about here, "they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell to the ground and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they presented to him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh." So it was valuable enough to give somebody to give to a king for a gift. So myrrh was very valuable. And as I said, it was used to embalm. In fact, Nicodemus embalmed Jesus with myrrh. John 19, verses 39 through 40, "Nicodemus, who had first come to him," to Jesus, "by night, also came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. They took the body of Jesus, bound it in linen wrappings with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews." So it was used to embalm people, not only in Egypt, but in Israel. So this was a typical trading caravan that came along, and when they saw it, they had an idea. The brothers did, instead of killing him, let's sell him into slavery. We see Judah coming up with the idea in Genesis 37, verses 26 and 27. "Judah said to his brothers, 'What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh.' And his brothers listened to him." Now, there were disadvantages to killing Joseph, whether directly by stabbing him, slicing him up, or putting him indirectly by putting him into a pit and starving him to death. Either way, the murder was likely to be discovered. And guess who's going to be held accountable for that? And even if the murder was not discovered, God would know it and might hold them accountable. Maybe they've still got enough fear of God where they might worry about what God might do to them. I sort of doubt it. But they might have been afraid of what people might do, like their father, for example, if he found out that they had killed him. So a lot of disadvantages to killing Joseph. And so Judah has this bright idea, let's sell him into slavery. Now, one cannot help but ask himself, did Judah say that just to take the heat off the brothers if they murdered him? Or did he say that because he had some concern for Joseph? He cared about him. We would hope the latter. I don't know whether he was a hypocrite or not, but he did say, hey, he's our brother, our own flesh, so let's don't kill him. So it sounds like he has some concern for him. Whether he was sincere or not, I don't know. But the brothers listened and they decided not to kill Joseph. So now they've softened their original purpose, which was to kill him directly, and then they wanted to put him into a pit with no food or water, so that was a little bit more softening, and now they've softened even more. They're going to sell him into slavery. And this would appeal to the brothers, too, because Judah is appealing to a natural human aversion to fratricide. As hard as those brothers were, to kill your own brother, that's serious business. And so Judah appeals to it, and they listen to him. Slavery, rather than murder, still suited the brothers' purpose. Their purpose was to keep Joseph from having dominion over them, and selling him into slavery where he is out of their hair would serve that purpose. We go now to Genesis 37, verses 28 through 30. "Then some Midianite traders passed by," these are the Ishmaelites, same people, "so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit," that's the brothers did, not the Midianites, but the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites, that's the Midianites, same people, "for 20 shekels of silver." And I stop here, 20 shekels? It was 30 pieces of silver was the price of a slave in the law, and also in Jesus' time. Judas sold Jesus out for 30 shekels of silver. Joseph didn't even get but 20. He must have been a pitiful sight. He was young. He was only 17. That might have had something to do with it. "Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. Now Reuben returned to the pit." Now, he was coming back to the pit to get Joseph out and set him free. "Reuben returned to the pit." He obviously had not been around when he heard the discussion about selling Joseph into slavery. He wasn't there. He was on his way to the pit, but he missed that discussion. When he got there, Joseph was not in the pit. So he, Reuben, tore his garments. He returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go?" Reuben was going to pull Joseph out, and he was probably going to take Joseph back to his father, as John Gill says. But he was frustrated in his aims. He says, "Where am I to go?" Reuben knows he's in trouble with Jacob. He's already in enough trouble for sleeping with his father Jacob's concubine, Bilhah, and now he's got to go back and say, hey, I'm the oldest son. I know I slept with your concubine, and I got some more bad news for you, Dad. Your favorite son, Joseph, is gone. Lost. I assume the brothers told Reuben that he had been sold into slavery, so Reuben at that time knew what happened to Joseph, that he was gone, sold into slavery, and so he could tell his father, Jacob, he's gone. He's been sold into slavery to Egypt. Well, no, he wouldn't say that. Well, he was thinking he might have to say that, but the brothers came up with the idea of faking his death by a wild beast, but that was before Reuben. Before they did that, Reuben's thinking, I got to go back and tell my father he sold into slavery, and he's gone. Reuben was a pitiful character. We go now to Genesis 37, verses 31 through 36. So they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the vari-colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, we found this. Please examine it to see whether it is your son's tunic or not. Then he examined it and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. So Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son. So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. So now the cover-up begins. He was killed by a wild animal. We didn't sell him into slavery. We didn't put him in a pit to starve him to death. We didn't kill him. A wild animal got him. So Jacob had no peace from his family for most of his life. The deceiver, Jacob the deceiver. His wives, Leah and Rachel, bickered. His daughter, Dinah, was raped by Shechem. His sons, Simeon and Levi, commit murder when they murder the Shechemites in response to that rape. His oldest son commits incest with his concubine, thus making a premature claim for his inheritance. And now his own sons trick him into thinking his son Joseph is dead. So Jacob got his inheritance when he deceived Esau. You recall that, you know, with the furry sheepskins on the back of his hands and on his neck and all that. He deceived his blind father Esau to get the inheritance. Well, Jacob, whose name means deceiver, now his own sons deceive him royally. So Jacob goes into mourning. Now, who participates in this mourning? Verse 35, all of his sons. His sons, the people who sold him into slavery, as Adam Clark said. Such hypocrisy on the brother's part. I should say, those people had chutzpah, those patriarchs. Along with the sons, all of Jacob's daughters arose to comfort him. Now, who were the daughters? There's only one that's recorded in Genesis. That's Dinah in the scriptures. Dinah. Here's some options as to who the other daughters were. This is my idea. Maybe some born later to his wives, but left unrecorded. Remember, Rachel's dead now, but Leah's still alive, and we've still got his concubines, Bilhah and Zilpah. They're still alive. They could have given birth to daughters who were not recorded. Could be his daughters-in-law, the people who married his 12 sons. Gill and Clark suggest that. Some people might object, well, the brothers are still young. How could they have wives? Well, Simeon is about 24, according to John Gill. That would give him enough time to get married and have one daughter. And that's all he needs. To say daughters, all it has to be is one more daughter to add to Dinah. Well, and that would be the daughters that arose to comfort him. So that's not really a problem. It's just we don't know who the daughters were. And then Abraham says, Surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son. Now, Sheol is the Hebrew word for Hades. And it means the place of the dead or the grave or death in general. So he was saying, I will go to my grave in mourning for my son. We can't really use that to prove the afterlife, by the way, because Sheol, as I say, could just mean I go down to my grave. Just like we say, I'll go to my grave. It means you go to the place in the earth. It doesn't mean you go to the afterlife. But at any rate, he's going to mourn for his son the rest of his life. He's a pitiful life Jacob has lived. So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. That was providential, as we'll see when we get to the rest of the story. But first, in our next audio, we're going to take up the story of Judah sleeping with his daughter-in-law Tamar, which is quite an interesting story. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.